Welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. Coming up this week, AI for good, with the leader of a Microsoft initiative using artificial intelligence to address some of the world's biggest challenges. First, a quick preview of the upcoming month on the show. Next week, we'll be talking more about the potential of AI with Werner Vogels, the Amazon CTO. On April 20th, my colleague John Cook and I will have a preview of the GeekWire Awards and a look back at the event's track record of predicting some of the region's tech titans. And on April 27th, I'll have a conversation with Dana Mattioli, Wall Street Journal reporter and author of the upcoming book, The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. It's going to be a big month, so be sure to subscribe to the GeekWire podcast to catch all those episodes if you haven't already, and help us spread the word by rating and reviewing the show on your favorite podcast app. Okay, let's jump in with this week's episode. Computer scientist Juan Lavista Ferris is the corporate vice president and chief data scientist at Microsoft and the lab director of Microsoft's AI for Good research lab, leading a team of data scientists and researchers in AI, machine learning, and statistical modeling, focusing on global challenges like health, climate change, and digital literacy. He's one of the editors and authors of the new book, AI for Good, Applications in Sustainability, Humanitarian Action, and Health, featuring case studies from Microsoft, which will be published by Wiley on April 9th. Juan, it's great to have you here.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
So we are actually here at your office in Redmond at the AI for Good lab. Let's start by just talking about what goes on here, what's surrounding us here in this office, and what kinds of work do the researchers and scientists here do?
So this is a philanthropic effort that Microsoft has, where we are a group of data scientists in different areas in the world. We have a lab here in Redmond. We have a lab in New York. We have a lab in Nairobi. We have a group of people in Uruguay, South America. We have postdocs in Colombia. We have postdocs in Massachusetts and also in Canada. As a philanthropic effort, we are working together with subject matter experts to help solve some of the world's greatest challenges.
I've spent a lot of time with this book, AI for Good, and it really details a lot of the work that you're doing. And the thing that I like about it is it's extremely tangible. It talks about specific projects, why they matter, how the researchers did them, and there are these common challenges and opportunities that come up as part of this process. So I want to go into some of those concrete case studies as we talk. But first off, there's so much discussion in the world about the potential negative of AI. And in the book, you're certainly not blind to that. You spend a lot of time talking about the ethics, guardrails. This book is clear-eyed when it comes to some of the negatives of AI. However, much of the book focuses on AI for good. What is the potential for AI to do good in the world when you look at the next 3, 4, 5 years?
We have to remember as a society, like AI is not certainly not new. We've been using AI, even in production settings, for more than 30 years. And AI is older than 30 years. And since the inception of AI, the bulk majority of the use cases that AI has been used has significantly helped society. And we expect this to even be broader, basically, with more capabilities, including large language models. We are now being able to solve problems that before we couldn't solve using AI. So I'm certainly extremely optimistic about the uses of AI. What I think is important to recognize is that, yes, as any tool, we need to make sure that we understand how to use the tool. We need to make sure that we understand the data that we're using. This is, for us, why it's so critical for us to work with subject matter experts. So to better understand the problems that we're trying to solve, and our contribution is more on the data science or AI perspective, but this is why it's critical to be working with subject matter experts in these problems. Majority of these problems, by being able for us to measure these problems, we will be able to make an impact. So I think that we're just starting on the type of impact we can get from AI, and I hope in the next 5, 10 years, we will see much more impact of this technology can have on society.
I was really struck by the projects where AI was able to do things far beyond the capabilities of humans. It wasn't just about automating a human process or replacing a human function. And one of those projects that really stuck with me was wildlife bioacoustics detection. This idea that through microphones and other means of collecting audio from the wilderness and remote locations around the world, researchers are able to get a much better sense for the state of ecosystems, the state of different endangered species. And at times, there are overlapping audio sounds that a human ear could not pick up. And yet the AI could do it, not only at a large scale, but at a pace that humans could never do. I started to get chills because you think about this type of application and the potential, and it's pretty powerful.
Bioacoustic data provides an amazing potential. And like you say, it's one of these problems where as humans, you need a huge level of expertise to try to even just without any other noise to differentiate between species. And we work with some of them, but there's not enough of those. There's thousands of millions of hours of recordings, which would be impossible for any human just to listen to those recordings. Now, we have these experts that can help us train those models. They basically do annotation where they identify the species. We train models that can identify those species from those sound recordings. And then we can use the models to help them understand the species. And in the case of the Amazon, we've been working, that example is not in the book, but we've been working now for the last year on the Amazon forest. This is a collaboration that we have with an organization in Colombia, where they have recordings since 1992.
Wow.
And now for the first time, now they're going to be using these models that just to help them understand any changes in the forest. And this is a great way to understand the health of the Amazon in many ways. And they can go back in time because they have the recordings starting 1992. Some of those recordings, they have been analyzed. But the fact that now we have AI models that can analyze this information, we can do this at scale. That before it would have been impossible to even think that this was possible.
The world's eyes were open to the potential of AI in the general public over the past 18 months through large language models, as exemplified by ChatGPT. Many of the examples in this book, to your point earlier, are about machine learning, things that have been going on for a long time. And yet it feels like, based on what you're saying here, some of these things have been unlocked even though you're still applying machine learning. Why is that?
Two things, even large language models, even the models that are behind GPT, those are still machine learning models. What I think is critical to understand that while large language models are not necessarily new, the potential that technologies like GPT brought is immense in the sense that natural language processing is one of the most difficult tasks. And I've been working in AI for the last 20 years. And if you had asked me a few years ago, I would have said, like, no, it's likely impossible to get to the level of impact that these models are having today. Because, again, like, we've been working with natural language processing for many years, and it is difficult. And is what I think is important for people to understand is that it's more difficult to work with text than to work with images. And one of the reasons why it's difficult is because if you're working on an image, let's say you have a camera trap and there's a picture of a cheetah, and you need to try to see whether in that picture you have a cheetah or not. That's a computer vision problem. It's a difficult problem in many ways. But all the information that the model needs is inside that image. That's not the case in text. Majority of the information when you're reading something is not in just those words. It's in the context. It's in things that are not part of that text, which makes it much more difficult for a model to learn. And the fact that now we have these large language models training this huge corpus of data makes many of these problems that were before impossible, now possible. We also have to recognize the fact that majority of our human knowledge is stored on the web. And now for the first time, we are able to try to get all this knowledge into something that can be managed by computers that before it wasn't the case. So very positive about the potential of many of the problems that now we will be able to solve using this technology.
Along these lines, the chapter in the case study on the proliferation of misinformation online was interesting to me from some of these same threads that we're talking about. The project analyzed the ways that people navigate specific sites that had been determined to be purveyors of misinformation. Can you talk a little bit more about that project?
Yeah, this has been a collaboration with a group from Princeton University, and part of their job was to try to better understand how people navigate the web and go into these rabbit holes of from one disinformation site to another disinformation site, and how that whole ecosystem works. We collaborated with them. We were bringing our expertise in these data science techniques. And it was certainly very insightful to understand this information. It's a big problem for society. And I think that the more we know about how people interact with this information, the better we will be prepared as a society to try to combat that.
You said rabbit hole, and that's what I scribbled down on top of this chapter in the copy of the book that I was reading, because that is the pattern that is consistent with misinformation and disinformation sites. You just get sucked in from article to article to article, and you're not necessarily going from one site to the next to the next. They're not linking out and around in the same way that a site that is trying to convey accurate information might be.
Yeah, that's correct. And what we found is exactly that, is majority of these websites that are categorized as misinformation sites usually have higher chances of having links to other misinformation sites. So once people navigate through some of these sites, it's easier to stay in the disinformation ecosystem.
Coming up, more examples of AI for good.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
On another somewhat controversial topic that's addressed in the book, the long-term effects of COVID, this was an interesting one for me, not necessarily because of the findings, which included the fact that people who were older might be more likely to sustain longer-term effects of COVID, but because the data was so important. And I thought it was impressive here that the researchers acknowledged that they did not have the ideal data set to make this determination.
Yeah, that's correct. And this is something that we have seen, like I mentioned before, majority of the data sources out there are usually not perfect. And this is another example where it would be really not appropriate to work without a subject matter expertise. And the data we use in this case is claims data.
Billing
data. And the beauty of this data set is that it has millions of people, like over 30% of private insurance are in this data set. And so we can learn a lot from this information, but it has a lot of potential problems because it was collected for mainly billing. And this is why we partner with a researcher from Kaiser Permanente. He has dedicated a significant part of his life to understand and work with this type of data set. The many learnings and studies that come from this data set. But clearly, this is an example where you need the subject matter expertise to understand what is in the data, how you can use the data, how not to use the data. And that is something that is critical.
Whereas patient diagnostic data might have provided a much clearer picture, that's something that's much harder to obtain. HIPAA regulations.
Yeah, exactly. And not even that. It's unfortunately that a lot of these data sets are usually not something that can even be combined. Different hospitals, different groups will have stored the data in different formats, which makes it very difficult, first from an access perspective, but even if we forget about access, it's not even possible to work with that data. So it is certainly a challenging area, and this is why I think this data set is not perfect. But at least if you have experts that understand what to do and how not to do the data, you can still gain information from the data sets.
What makes for a high-quality, impactful AI initiative these days at an abstract level? What are the ingredients and the processes that lead to the best results based on the current state of technology?
I think this starts with recognizing that in order for us to have an impact, we need people to be using these models in a production setting. And I always say that there's a big difference between solving a problem in theory and solving a problem in practice. That distance between theory and practice is larger in practice than in theory. And I think it's important to work with organizations that have not only the subject matter expertise, but also the capabilities to put these models later on in production. Our job is to help them solve these problems, but their job will be to work and make eventually these models into production settings. And that's challenging. That is actually quite challenging. When we look at projects, we see our first criteria is the project impactful, meaning that if we solve this problem, is this a project that will have an impact in the world? And the second criteria is, can we solve the problem? Because not every problem can be solved with AI or machine learning or data science in general. Not all the problems, but there's a subset of projects that can do that. The third criteria is, do we have data? Do our partners or does data exist? And once you start going into the funnel, then you ask the question, if the data exists, do we have the right subject matter experts on the other side? Are we working with the right subject matter experts? And we try our best to work with the best data, like the best experts for that problem. And the last part of the criteria is, well, if we solve it with these people, with the data, could we do the knowledge transfer to this organization so they can use this type of problems in production? And that's usually the most challenging.
I would say on that last criterion that you just cited, one that stood out to me was a collaboration with the Carter Center monitoring the Syrian war with natural language processing. I'd love to have you describe that and explain how that can be transferred then to that organization for their use in their day-to-day operations.
Yeah, we had an amazing collaboration with Carter Center, and they bring not only a great subject matter experts in these problems, but also they have very great technical capabilities. And they collect information from multiple sources, like usually open source sources, where they bring all of the information. They have analysts that look at the information. What the problem they're trying to solve is have a near real-time assessment of potential conflicts around the world. And they get this information from news sources, sometimes in multiple languages, that are across the world. And usually they would have an analyst reading this, and many analysts reading this information and trying to come up with an assessment whether they were seeing a conflict arises in certain countries or certain areas and try to identify where. They were doing this by hand. And we use that data set that they've been using, and we use natural language processing. This was before GPT. We actually use for some of these projects, we use early versions of GPT. And by doing these models, we could do the classification. These models were as good as these experts on classifying whether there was a conflict or not, or what type of conflict, what it was, and try to do this location, which allowed them, for these experts, to be focused on what they were best, is trying to see what they could do with that data. So that has been a really impactful project. This is one of the examples where suddenly they have all of this in production. We continue to collaborate with them. We have that knowledge transferred to them, and we continue doing a great collaboration between us and the Carter Center, an amazing organization doing an amazing impact in the world.
Reading that case study, it struck me that would be a fundamental advance in a critical function within that organization.
Exactly, because it allowed them to have much more real-time information and allow them to consume much more sources than before. They were completely tied to the amount of people that they had working. And even if those people were working full-time, just reading these news, it would be impossible for them to scale. This allowed them to scale and to focus those resources in what was most important for them.
But what can the rest of us learn and apply from these projects? That's coming up next.
This GeekWire podcast is sponsored in part by Yale University Press. Are you concerned about the rise of AI and how it will impact our society? Every day, artificial intelligence presents us with urgent ethical challenges. How do we harness this extraordinary technology to empower rather than oppress? Nigel Shadbolt and Roger Hampson have written a how-to for building ethical machine intelligence. Their new book, As If Human, Ethics and Artificial Intelligence, is now available wherever books are sold.
So you and your team are thinking big. You're looking to impact the world. The rest of us might have more mundane obstacles and challenges that we're just figuring out how to apply AI to. Are there principles, things that the rest of us can learn from these examples in the book and in Microsoft's AI for Good research organization that the rest of us can put into practice in our own lives and work?
I think the first exercise, and this is why we decided to write the book, is to show examples. A lot of times when we're working with subject matter experts on other organizations, it was difficult. Sometimes if you don't understand what type of problems you can solve, it's difficult for them to think how they can use AI. So one of the things that we saw that worked very well was when working with those organizations, we would present the type of problems that we were solving for other organizations that maybe had nothing to do, but then people could use them. And let me give you an example that I think was resonates really well. One of the early projects that we were working in acoustic data was trying to detect beluga whales. This is sound, like underwater sound. Try to detect the beluga whales. And we showed that we were doing really well. That was our first acoustic data project was with beluga whales. This was with working with amazing researchers here at NOAA. And we showed that we could train an AI model to detect acoustic information. In a presentation working with another organization that their focus was to monitor the Syrian war conflict, they asked, like, could we potentially use this acoustic data to detect a type of weapons that are being used and they shouldn't be used because they would be against the Geneva Convention? And we say, well, as long as this information had a particular, like what we call acoustic fingerprint, the answer is yes. And we work with them and we show them that we could use these type of models to detect the type of information that they wanted from this. So for us, it's really important to show the world real world examples on how we can use AI to solve these problems. And hopefully these allow other scientists, researchers, or just people working to say, hey, we could potentially use AI to solve this particular problem.
Very interesting. And to your point, humans pattern match, much like AI, although perhaps not quite as efficiently. And so as I was reading these examples in the book, I kept thinking, data is so important as the raw material, and obviously subject matter expertise and everything else along those lines and a purpose to what you're doing are critical as well. But you've got to have the data as a raw material to start to work with. How do you get that data? What would be your advice to folks out there who perhaps aren't working in such philanthropic areas to find those data sets they need to have real impact with AI?
Yeah, data is the fundamental aspect of AI. Whenever we think about AI, behind the scenes is mainly data. People say data is the new oil. Data is the new code. So it is clearly the most important portion of an AI model. And to answer your question, there are two aspects. First, it's really important to make sure that we do our best job to collect the data, making sure that we don't introduce biases in the way that we collect the data, making sure that we collect the data in a way that can be used for AI models. But more important, there's also a significant amount of open data sets out there. And that's something that we also contribute to society. Whenever we work on these projects, when possible, because sometimes it's not possible because the organizations do not want to share, we try to open source the data sets. So if you go to our website, you will find a lot of data sets that we have open source. But we're not alone. Like, there's a whole open data movement out there where more and more organizations are open sourcing their data sets, and that people can use that data for training models and trying to solve their problems.
The other thing that struck me reading some of the examples was just how much customization development must be taking place behind the scenes. I mean, you've got a crew of computer scientists and data scientists out here. The rest of us don't necessarily have those resources at our disposal. How long until we start to see more of these advanced AI capabilities in off-the-shelf AI products versus bespoke research applications?
But I think like the first answer is a lot of things are there already, thanks to Copilots or ChatGPT, where for the first time, anybody can access and just using their language, be able to use AI, correct? That's the what we are seeing today with technology like Copilots or ChatGPT is what a lot of times computer scientists had, but they required to code. Now we have the ability to code in our own language. We have to remember that less than 0.5% of people in the world know how to code. Now this technology has the capability for us to code in our own language, whether that's English, Spanish, or Mandarin. We have the ability to convert our natural language into coding. But more and more, thanks to that technology, we will see many more tools that will allow anybody to do things that before would have required coding skills. And we are seeing that already, right? Like the ability for us to upload an image and get like a vision model. Before, it would take a lot of coding, a lot of training. Now, anybody can just, by typing, you can do that today. And we expect this trend to continue. So it will be more and more, it will become relatively easier for people to use this type of technology to solve their problems.
Obviously, you're focused on the potential for AI to make positive change. What are your biggest concerns about the potential for AI and its impact on the world?
I think it's critical for people to understand what are the use cases of AI and how to be use AI responsibly. Like as a society, any technology, not just AI, but any technology like the Microsoft president, Brad Smith, have mentioned many times, can be used as a tool or as a weapon. As a society, we have a responsibility to maximize the use of tools and minimize any potential use of this technology as a weapon. And that's why Microsoft has created a responsible AI office, and we've been having principles of AI, responsible AI, for more than 7 years now. That aspect is critical as a society to work together to make sure that this technology can be used for good.
Thank you very much for sitting down and talking with me.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Juan Lavista Ferris is the Corporate Vice President and Chief Data Scientist at Microsoft and the Lab Director of Microsoft's AI for Good Research Lab. The new book, AI for Good, Applications in Sustainability, Humanitarian Action, and Health, is out on April 9th. Thanks for listening. Kurt Milton edited this episode. I'm GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the GeekWire podcast.